Today's show is brought to you by Underbrush, a new thriller by Kevin Carr. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Amazon Prime.
Couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Big fat New Year's. Welcome to everybody. Welcome to 2015. We are rolling into the new year with new movies and hopefully some good movies. Maybe not the first week of the year, because it's always a terrible time to release movies first week of the year, but there's some gems in there too. This week I'm going to be talking about The Woman in Black 2, Angel of Death, Wreck 4, A Most Violent Year, and The Interview. And I'm also going to be talking about news and the trailer park, box office predictions, the DVD roundup, and of course, I will give you my best and worst films of 2014 later in the episode. But first, this is how you can get in touch with me if you want to reach me. You can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can reach me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies and on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr. Before we roll into the news, one of the things I did want to say, I'm going to start doing something this year where you can submit a movie to me that I haven't seen. Now, if I've seen it, I'm not going to watch it again. But if there's movies that I haven't seen or you think I should see, I'll set up a special email. You can email me or you can get me through any of those ways and suggest movies that you want to hear my take on. And it'll be a Fat Guy Picks. That's going to be one of the things I'm going to be doing this year, just to kind of reach out and see if there have been movies that I have been missing and should be catching up on.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. Actually, pretty small news week. Two things I really want to talk about. The first one, more about The Interview. I'm going to be talking about that later. I finally watched it over Christmas. We rented it on video on demand and for $5.99 and enjoyed it at home, and that was kind of cool. One of the things that's interesting is that it had made over the weekend of Christmas, over the Christmas and into the weekend, it made $15 million in VOD sales, which is phenomenal. That's huge for any VOD release, especially for just that limited several days that it was starting out. And that's in addition to the $3 million theatrical that it took in the smaller 331 theaters. Yeah, you know, it's a good thing that all those other theaters backed off, because remember all those stories about these theaters that were being blown up by the North Koreans? How many times did that happen? None. So it was really the pansies in the national theater chains like AMC and Regal and Carmike that wussed out on this whole thing. Originally, before all this stuff happened, it was tracking to be about $20 million as a prediction for opening weekend release. So with the $15 million VOD and the $3 million in its opening week in cinemas, it came pretty close to that. Now, it's not a publicity stunt. Please stop saying that, because Sony lost their shirts in this whole thing, because they're not going to get the VOD as gravy anymore. The VOD is now has to replace the box office and the theatricals. This movie is still in financial trouble. Sony's way in trouble. The hack was not a publicity stunt. It was likely an inside job, and at least somebody was involved in it, and they're actually finding evidence towards that. Was it linked to North Korea? That's something else for somebody else to debate. It was not Sony saying, hey, let's release all this financial information from our people and embarrass our own executives and tank a movie that we're spending $75 million plus on to market and promote just to get $18 million back on its opening weekend. This was not a publicity stunt. This was an attack and a problem from an outside source. Who did it and exactly how it went, that's something to be debated. But what this does is this paves the way, not for movies like The Avengers or Star Wars, but for smaller releases. Movies that are either smaller or middling releases that they're not expecting huge numbers for. If you promote them right, you can do day and date VOD, which very small releases, independent movies that are coming out of like through IFC and Magnet and Magnolia Releasing and these smaller companies, this now justifies it for bigger releases. You can get $10 million. And if you're not going to make if you think you're going to be grossing about $10 million for a movie on opening weekend, drop it on VOD. You might actually get better. We're going to see repercussions of this later on. One other piece of news, and this comes out of the whole Sony hack, and the reason I'm going to cover it is because it's not really news, because this has been talked about for years. There was this hubbub talking about Idris Elba being lofted as a name for James Bond, that supposedly the Sony people wanted him to be the next James Bond, possibly after Daniel Craig leaves. Well, first of all, the rumors of a black James Bond have been going on for 10 years. Ever since that they were trying to pick Daniel Craig, there were people saying, well, maybe we could have a black James Bond. And there's a discussion about this 10 years ago. And then last year, when Idris Elba and Naomi Harris were in that Long Walk to Freedom Nelson Mandela movie, because they worked together and they've worked together before on British television, they asked her, because she plays Moneypenny in the new James Bond movies, they asked her if she thought he would be a good James Bond, and she was, of course, responding. This is not a new story. It just was sort of reignited by the emails and the Sony hack. And there's some people come out and said, well, you can't have a black James Bond, or you should try to have a black James Bond. Here's the thing. I don't want a black James Bond. I want a James Bond. Now, if he happens to be black, great. But I don't want them casting so we have a black James Bond any more than I want them casting so we have a white James Bond. Now, if you say a name of an actor like Idris Elba, I think, wow, he would actually be a great James Bond. I don't care what the color of his skin is. The guy has it. He's big and he's imposing and he's strong and he's a great actor and he's formidable and he would be a great super spy. Same thing happened when people had a blonde James Bond coming on the scene with Daniel Craig. They were like, you can't have a blonde James Bond. Well, it doesn't matter. He makes a great James Bond. You want a black-haired white guy to play James Bond? Pauly Shore. Just because he's white does not mean Pauly Shore is going to be a good James Bond. He'd be awful. Sony and anyone casting a movie should cast for the character, not for skin color. And I mean, if you're going to cast Abraham Lincoln, you kind of have to have a white guy for Abraham Lincoln. It just doesn't work. Unless there's some sort of historical character element that makes it impossible to have them of a certain race. That's the only time you, like, they have Selma coming out. You couldn't have cast a white guy or a Hispanic guy or an Asian as Martin Luther King. You just can't, because that's what he's known for and that's what he did. That was integral to his character. Cast appropriately. James Bond doesn't have to be Scottish. James Bond doesn't have to be white. You need a guy to play James Bond who's very James Bond. And if he happens to be a black guy, great. As opposed to when Paramount was casting the Star Trek shows like Voyager with first Genevieve Bejeweled, and then they replaced her with Kate Mulgrew, and they did Deep Space Nine, and they got Avery Brooks. They cast for a female captain or a black captain. That was the purpose. That was what Star Trek was doing. And they got weak captains. I never thought Brooks or Mulgrew did a good job as a captain. I thought they were sort of weak, and I thought they were being cast more for what they represented than actually being a good actor. Whereas you got Patrick Stewart or William Shatner even for Captain Kirk. He was great for Captain Kirk. Patrick Stewart was great for Picard. You cast for what you need, not what they need to look like in your mind. For the record, I'm all for Idris Elba playing James Bond. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Really quickly, you hear that noise? That means it's time to move on into the trailer park. The first one is The Duff, which opens on February 20th.
Here's my favorite Duff.
What?
D-U-F-F, designated ugly fat friend. It's not like a big deal. Every group of friends has one. You're the one who's approachable. You friended up. Good for you.
People like you will never matter.
Forget her. Prove her wrong.
I don't want to be anybody's Duff. Help me with this.
On one condition. You gotta ask me in your monster voice.
From when we were little?
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember it.
Okay.
Whoa, 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 whoa!
I think it looks like it's trying to be sort of that edgy teen send-up, sort of like something like Easy A, which I wasn't a huge fan of. It might be okay. It doesn't feel as edgy as something like Pitch Perfect, even though it's, I think, trying to go for the same crowd. But Mae Whitman's, she's funny, and I think she has a command of the screen. The next one I want to hit on is Everly. Opens on February 27th.
You betrayed me. My men are already there. You will die in that room tonight, Everly.
There's no way out. What are you going to do?
I know I'm going to die tonight.
This is, of course, Salma Hayek doing the John Wick thing. Salma Hayek's beautiful and she's gorgeous. And I think she works at times in action movies, like in Desperado. But I just don't buy her as a badass. I'm sorry. She just doesn't have the presence that somebody like, say, Uma Thurman had in Kill Bill. So this one kind of looks weak, in my opinion. We'll find out in February. Anyways, with that, I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Woman in Black 2, Angel of Death, and Wreck 4, Apocalypse. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and it's free to borrow with Amazon Prime. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, rolling into the new movies of the year. This isn't just the new movies of the week. This is the new movies of the year. There's two of them. The ones we're going to be talking about in the next segment are actually movies that got limited releases already in the States in 2014. These are the new ones. I'm on the cutting edge, which doesn't mean a whole lot for January because January has some pretty awful releases. We'll see what these are like, though. First one I want to talk about is The Woman in Black 2, Angel of Death. During World War II, a group of children are sent to the country up north in England, only to discover that they have been placed in a haunted house. What could possibly go wrong?
Where are you headed?
We're heading to Crith and Gifford. They have no other relatives, so we're taking them to a house in the country. Does anybody else live on the island?
The place has been deserted for years.
There it is, Healmarsh House.
Everybody, into your beds.
Hello? Are you sure there's nobody else living here?
I think you should keep your visions to yourself.
This is a sequel to The Woman in Black, which came out 3 years ago. It was in, I believe, 2012, and it starred Daniel Radcliffe. It came out right at the beginning of February, so it released a little later in the year comparatively. And it's most notable for being the first movie that Daniel Radcliffe did completely after the Harry Potter series had wrapped. And a lot of eyes were on it then because there was, you know, could he do it? Can he carry a movie outside of the Wizarding School of Hogwarts? And he did. He did a fine job. And he's actually moved on to do some pretty wild and different stuff. You know, he did Horns last year and he did What If last year. He did that one with about Allen Ginsberg, Kill Your Darlings. He's picking some interesting roles and he's trying not to get pigeonholed. And he's not also straying away from the genre fiction, which is good. I like the fact that Daniel Radcliffe isn't avoiding genre fiction, but he's also not diving into the point where he becomes a joke of himself. But here's the thing. He has nothing to do with this movie. It was just the first one. And there's nobody of any note whatsoever in this release. Now, it is done by Hammer, which, if you don't know who Hammer is the British production company that back in the 50s, they started to do basically their own British version of the Universal Monster movies. They did Frankenstein and Dracula and The Mummy, and they had they fostered the stars like Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. They really got a lot of note from doing these films, which are fantastic movies, lots of fun. But they're known for being a little more even keeled. They're not as gimmicky as, say, some of the modern American horror releases like Platinum Dunes or something like that. Having Hammer's hands on it, you're getting a different movie than what you normally get. As a horror movie, first week of the year, you're usually getting found footage. Like last year, I think it was a Paranormal Activity, The Marked Ones, that I think was the first release of 2014. And then the couple years before that, you had The Devil Inside. And they always have a crappy found footage horror movie because nobody wants to release anything of any cost then. And those things tend to do relatively popular with the teenage and high school and college crowds. They tend to do well. This is a good time, at least on the books, to release a horror movie. But here's the thing. This is a slow burn horror movie. This is not found footage. This is much more similar to a movie like Oculus or something like that from last year. These slow burn haunted house kind of movies. And it's very British and it feels much more like a television production in it just going for the atmosphere and the suspense. It's not a bad film. It's not awful. And I know that sounds sort of, you know, like a backhanded compliment, but for a movie that released in the first week of the year, when they usually are just terrible. This one's not bad. It's not great. It's lacking a lot. It's lacking any real punch. It's lacking any real star that can command the movie. That's one of the things that helped the first one is, you know, Daniel Radcliffe was there. He was a good focal point for the movie. And this one, it's this British girl who I don't even know. And there's a British guy in it. And there are kids, and it's kids in trouble. And so it does kind of feel a bit... We've seen these movies before. Stuff like Mama came out a couple of years ago. And they work to a degree for atmosphere. And I saw it, and it wasn't terribly full, the theater. And I was afraid it was going to be very talky because it's a slow movie. And I was afraid all these groups of teenagers that were in the audience were going to be a pain during it. But they actually were okay. And, you know, it has some scares. It has some creepy moments. It's very predictable. But it's at least different from some of the crap that's being just shoved down our throats. And it's a PG-13 movie, but it doesn't feel like it's been sanitized to PG-13. Something like, what was that movie? Oh, with Ashley Green a couple years ago. The Apparition, I think it was called The Apparition. Or like Ouija last year seemed very sanitized for teenage viewing. This one does have a PG-13 rating, but it doesn't feel like it's marginalized for PG-13. Still, it's got a lot of stuff missing that you would need in a better movie. So I'm going to have to say The Woman in Black 2, Angel of Death, kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next release is another horror movie. We're going to be talking about Wreck 4 Apocalypse. This is a Spanish movie, so you're going to hear a little bit of foreign language in the trailer. Don't freak out. After containing the survivors of a demonic zombie virus outbreak, the disease is once again unleashed on a ship that is transporting them across the ocean.
Señora.
Prepare for the final chapter of the epic horror franchise.
I've actually kind of enjoyed the Wreck movies. I know it's found footage. The first two are found footage, and that's absolutely true. And I hate found footage, but these were one of the first ones. And the first two movies in the series, it actually made sense. Very much so in the first one, but it actually made sense for it to be found footage. It wasn't just an excuse to do a gimmick. And they're very well done movies. The first one is then remade into Quarantine in America, which was good. Actually, the remake's very good. But what the remake did is it stripped out the spiritual element to it. As you watch the Wreck series, which they're obviously on the fourth one, there's some sort of demonic element to this. There's a religious side to it, which makes sense being, you know, coming from a lot of a Catholic background that permeates some of the productions, that, especially the horror films that are coming out of Spain nowadays. This sort of abandons a lot of the open thinking and the gee whiz, what if kind of thing. And it goes to just a straight zombie movie, which, or an outbreak movie. I mean, if you want to say it's like 28 days later where they sort of get this rage virus to them. They strip out a lot of the spiritual element in this movie and just make it sort of a monsters attacking people on a boat. But it's really good. It's a lot of fun. It's a crazy, nutso, insane, uber violent movie that is just kind of a roller coaster ride. And I enjoyed it. It's funny, my son, who's 11, and I show him some pretty crazy stuff. So this was nothing. This was nothing compared to some of the things he saw. And he's like, "Can I watch it with you?" And I said, "Yeah, sure. Sit down." And I thought the fact was great that not only is he not at all turned off or scared by demonic zombies, he also wasn't turned off or scared by subtitles, which is kind of amazing. I'm very proud of him. I thought it was a real proud moment of like, I'm raising him right. I got an 11-year-old kid that's like, it's a Spanish movie. You got to read. Okay. That's kind of cool. More people should be embracing subtitles in world cinema because there's some great stuff out there that's worth seeing. And, you know, just suck it up and read a couple subtitles now and then. Ultimately, I'm going to say that Wreck 4 Apocalypse kind of rocked.
It kind of rocks.
It's time to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about a most violent year and The Interview.
Open Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Open Gangnam Style.
Oh.
with Fat Guys in the Movies coming back from our horror movie segment, which were the two new movie releases. Rec 4, by the way, is available on demand, which is, like I said when I was talking about the interview. I mean, Rec 4 is going to have limited play in America anyways because it's subtitled. But what's interesting about that is it has an on-demand release along with its theatrical release, which is very standard for the Magnet and Magnolia releasing titles. And I will not be surprised if you see this showing up as bigger and bigger movie titles now that the interview show that you can make a decent amount of money on it. If you want to see Rec 4, you can go online and watch it now. Then don't pirate it, idiots. Like, it's like the interview. I had somebody on the radio ask me about people pirating the interview. And I'm like, it's $6 to rent the interview. It's $5.99. It would cost you more to buy a single ticket to go see it at the theater. The big thing that's going to happen now with video on demand is now they have to reconcile what they're going to price it as. Are they going to price it in higher than $5.99 for a release? At what point does it then start to lose revenue? Could they have made more if they charged $6.99 for the on-demand rental? And I'm expecting to see this starting to show up as the, like the studios, like Sony. I wouldn't be surprised if Sony has their smaller releases that they don't think is going to make $5 or $10 million on opening weekend, release those in the theaters. Now, obviously you're not going to get the level of saturation in the media that you had with the interview, but it's a viable option. They're already releasing stuff on demand early ahead of DVD and Blu-ray releases. I still don't think physical media is going away. I still think people want to hold something in their hand and they don't trust Disney to keep it on their servers if they want to watch Guardians of the Galaxy 5 years from now. Disney's notorious for putting stuff back in the vault. And even if you buy it, who knows what happens? I think people still want to have a viable copy that they can watch. But I wouldn't be surprised if you start seeing smaller releases getting VOD. Anyways, moving on to real theatrical releases, and this one you may not have a chance to see because this was released in very few theaters early this year. It's released this week, and that is A Most Violent Year. Actually, I think this may have come out limited in on the 31st, just for Oscar consideration. A businessman with a checkered past is trying to keep his fuel oil business growing amid pressure from the mob as well as the feds.
I run a fair and clean business, and I will fight till my last breath to prove that.
These are dangerous times and we have to adapt. It's not like when we was driving.
There were more murders and rapes in this city last year than there have ever been. So if you come to tell me that we have an urgent security issue here, trust me, I'm aware.
This can't continue. You're at war here.
It's been 2 years since you started investigating my industry. Do you have any idea who's been doing this to us?
This one, like I said, got a limited theatrical release for award consideration. Most critics have gotten a copy of it for a four-year consideration disc for their award cycle. It's directed by J.C. Chandor, who did one of my favorite movies of a couple years ago, Margin Call. I thought that was a fantastic examination of the inside of the Wall Street crisis. And this is him going into the past in 1981 to New York City, the most violent year on record for New York City with the most rapes and murders that had happened in the city. And it's a basic story of a guy kind of trying to go straight, which is not an uncommon story. That's nothing new. But a guy trying to run a legitimate business without cooking the books, without paying people off, without, you know, using heavies and intimidation and threats of violence. And it's an interesting look at that gray area between legitimate business and mob business. And the guy has ties to the mob, but he's trying to do things right. But at the same time, even though there are people that are trying to intimidate him, and they may have guns, nobody really wants to shoot the guns at anybody. But by bringing the guns to the party, you're making things extremely tense. It's a complex movie. It's a real slow burn. The acting's great. It's got Jason Isaacs in it. I think he's fantastic. It's got Albert Brooks in a great sort of small bit part as the lawyer. Jessica Chastain's in it. I'm not a huge fan of Jessica Chastain. And I don't buy her when she gets too aggressive, I guess you can say. Like when she was in Zero Dark Thirty a couple years ago, Zero Dark Thirty is an okay movie, but she just puffs out her chest a little too much to try and be, you know, the intimidating. She just doesn't come across. She comes across almost laughably. There's a scene in Zero Dark Thirty where she drops the F-bomb in the most awkward way. but it's meant for her to like show she's serious, and she's it just comes across, it'd be like my mom throwing out the F-bomb, or my dad for that matter. I could never hear my dad do the F-bomb, as opposed to like my grandfather and my uncle. They are really good at throwing out the F-bomb. But ultimately, A Most Violent Year is a good movie. It's worth checking out. It's worth seeing. It'll be rolling out in theatrical releases throughout January, and you're probably going to see it at least somewhere in award season. Whether or not it gets any Oscar nominations, I don't know. It still kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is the most controversial film of 2014. And that was, of course, The Interview. Seth Rogen and James Franco are sent to North Korea to assassinate dictator Kim Jong-un.
Look at this.
Kim Jong-un wants to do an interview with Dave Skylark?
He's a fan! Look at him! If that ain't a real story, what is?
Okay, let's do it.
We're going to North Korea!
You two are going to be in a room alone with Kim. The CIA would love it if you could take him out.
Hmm?
Take him out.
Like for drinks?
Like to dinner?
Take him out of the town?
No, take him out.
You want us to kill the leader of North Korea?
Yes.
What?
I remember when I first heard about this movie, and I played a trailer in the trailer park of this show. And I was like, this sounds ridiculous and funny and absurd. And I said, yeah, already back then, North Korea was making comments about how the way North Korea does, very boisterously saying they shouldn't be releasing this movie. And people, nobody paid attention to them. And then this whole thing with the terrorist threats from the Guardians of Peace and all that, which still arguably may not be North Korea, even though the FBI says it is. But when all is said and done and you watch this movie, it's just a stupid comedy. It's funny. I found it very funny. I found it to be at times very clever, but also very crass, which is what you'd expect. If you like Seth Rogen and James Franco stuff, if you liked Pineapple Express, even though Evan Goldberg didn't direct that one, but if you liked Pineapple Express, and more importantly, if you like This Is the End, which came out last year about the rapture, you'll like this movie. It's very typical James Franco and Seth Rogen. It is their style of humor. It's ridiculous and it's absurd. And in a weird way, it kind of humanizes Kim Jong-un more than anything else that could have been done. Yeah, it presents him as a buffoon, as an idiot, and as kind of a psychotic, narcissistic dictator. But it also presents him as kind of like just a guy who's in over his head. Which is kind of odd because, oh no, it makes sense. I mean, it's odd because it doesn't present him in this villainous Darth Vader, Count Dracula light. It presents him as a guy who doesn't know what the heck he's doing. And that's kind of, it's very humanizing. But of course, in North Korea, he wants to be presented as a god. It's just a dumb movie. That's what's kind of amazing about it. It's just a dumb movie. There's nothing really dangerous about the film. I mean, yeah, it has assassinating, a sitting dictator, but it's really not. If you look at it, you take it outside of the story that was surrounding it, there's nothing all that controversial about it. It's not even propaganda. I mean, it's not even like a movie that's meant to really make him look bad. It's just an absurd, dumb movie. And it's funny. It's very funny. It has some extremely hilarious scenes. Seth Rogen, I think, does a better job in it than James Franco. James Franco just plays this wild, crazy talk show host. And Seth Rogen really holds the movie together. He's the glue. And Lizzie Kaplan's in it, and she's beautiful. And I could always do with more of Lizzie Kaplan. But you watch the movie and you're like, this was the most controversial film of 2014. 20 years from now, we're going to look back at this and people are going to see this movie and be like, what's so controversial about it? It's not like notorious films have come along, stuff like Cannibal Holocaust, which showed them really butchering animals, or Faces of Death, these kind of things. You're like, you watch them now and you'd be like, well, they may have softened over the years, but you can still see why this disturbed people. People are going to watch this stuff 20, 50 years from now and be like, how did this upset anybody? But still, ultimately, I have to say The Interview kind of rocked. It's worth seeing. Rent it legally. Please download it legally.
It kind of rocks.
I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to talk about the best and worst of 2014, the box office, and the world famous DVD roundup. Let the sky fall. We will stand to our Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and it's free to borrow with Amazon Prime. What kind of feeling? I'm high on believing that you're in love with me. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. We are rolling into the final segment. Got some more stuff to talk about, including the best and the worst of 2014. I know a lot of people rush to get their lists out there. I know people who publish their list like in early to mid-December. Because if you're a film critic, generally you see all the movies early enough in December. By like the 15th, you've seen most of the movies. Because they send, especially the award consideration ones, because they send you the screeners early. And maybe you didn't get to see Annie early. That didn't release until the 18th or 19th. I finally had to go see it in the theaters. But I don't think anyone was expecting that to become a big award consideration or on anyone's really top 10 list. I'm only going to give my top three, mainly because we have limited time on the show. But also, if you really want to check them out, you can go to fatguysatthemovies.com and there'll be a link that you can see the list there that are the best of the year, the ones that I like the most. Let's talk about them now because even one now in this list, hint, hint, is not one that is out right now in wide release. The number three best film of 2014 was Guardians of the Galaxy, one of my favorite films of the year because it was such fun and it brought the Marvel Cinematic Universe into a totally different realm. It went outside of just the standard Avengers, which is a great story on its own, but it went somewhere else. It really felt like you were a kid back watching Star Wars again. It was just, it was so colorful and so bright and lots of humor and lots of fun, but it was still a great action-filled story. So Guardians of the Galaxy, number three. Number two was The Box Trolls. Anyone who knows me knows I love animation. And there's been a lot of animation out there this year, and there's some good stuff. Big Hero 6 was great. That made my top 10 list, but it didn't get up in the second spot. Part of why I love The Box Trolls is it's Laika. Laika has done movies like Paranorman and Coraline. It has such a rich history of stop-motion animation that is a lost art in Hollywood, and it's just so gorgeous looking. I so love the stop motion animation that Laika does, and it's an amazing film. This is a cute story about an out of the box story, no pun intended, about this group of trolls that live under this city and they think they're stealing babies, but they're really not. And it's this weird, bizarrely designed group of people and trolls. And it's just so clever and sweet and unique. You'll see nothing else like it. So The Box Trolls. Number one though, my favorite film of the year, and we'll be talking about this in a couple weeks, American Sniper. I'll give my full review later, but just to say, American Sniper, the story of Chris Kyle, the deadliest American sniper that's ever been in military history. This is directed by Clint Eastwood and a fantastic movie. A very different approach to a war film than what you've seen, and it really fits in with Eastwood's deliberate, slow style. And it tells it more from the point of view of the soldier, who doesn't get all the information, who just has to go and do a job. And yeah, there's a little bit of hero worship going on, and yeah, it does kind of take some liberties with the story and to make it more of a narrative. But ultimately, I thought it was one of the best presentations I've seen of an American serving, as well as an American recovering from the traumas of war. So those are my top three. The worst films, which is sometimes more fun to talk about because it's cathartic. It gets them out of your system. As most people only go see movies that they think they're going to like. As a critic, you got to go see everything. And I can't tell you how many times I'm sitting there at home and I know I'm going to hate a movie. And I'm just like, oh, I have to go see this movie. It looks so bad. And I still have to go see it and then talk about it. This is my chance to stick it to these movies that I had to go see. So number three was Left Behind. That one, of course, is the reboot of the Kirk Cameron saga based on best-selling series of books about people who live through the rapture. The only thing is, this is like the first chapter or two of the book. It all just takes place. It's very, very short. I think they wanted to make this massive long series. Either that or it was going to be a TV movie that they were hoping to get put into series, and then they decided to put it in theaters. It has Nicolas Cage just suffering through the movie. You could tell he just does not want to be there. but he needs the money. And it's the most boring rapture ever. And the theology is so dumbed down and insulting to everybody. Number two, A Haunted House. This one's Marlon Wayans' sequel to A Haunted House, which was my number eighth worst film from 2013. This is the sequel. It's even worse. It's sort of trying to still stay with the found footage angle because that's what the first one was, but then it just violates it all over the place. It doesn't quite make sense. It can't even follow its own rules. It's not funny. It's bad. And then number one, another found footage movie. Found footage came back with a vengeance in 2014. And Devil's Due was one of those early January releases about this couple that go on the honeymoon and then the wife gets pregnant with the devil's baby. It's just so poorly constructed and it has everything that makes a found footage movie terrible manifests itself in this film. From having to explain why they're filming constantly and just making the characters annoying about it to things happening, and then them saying, well, what happened last night? I don't know. Well, you were filming the whole thing. Just go back to your camera and go. I mean, because you know you were filming it. And they never do. It's just such a bad movie. It's so awful. And you know what? 2014, none of the found footage movies did very well. You had a whole bunch of them. In 2013, we got a break from it a bit. But they started moving outside of the horror genre. You had, Devil's Due, but then you had As Above, So Below, or The Paranormal Activity, the Mark ones. That's also on my top 10 worst film. But then they worked outside of the genre. Stuff like Into the Storm, which is also my top 10 worst films, which was supposed to be an action movie. Terrible. Then Earth to Echo, which was a sci-fi movie meant to be an homage to the Spielberg Amblin movies of the 80s, but it was found footage, which made it terrible. There's more found footage coming out next year, but the thing, I don't think any of them did very well this year, which is good. I think that the genre is falling apart. It cripples the storytelling process and it just becomes a gimmick. And now the movies are just about the gimmick. That's it for Best and Worst of the Year. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's move on and talk about what's going to be happening this weekend at the box office. First of all, last weekend, was I correct? I said $40 million for Into the Woods, and I was sort of right. It was $40 million was what I said for the four-day weekend, because you had to include Christmas Day in there as well. And it made $46 million over the four-day, and tying almost precisely with Unbroken, which did far better than I thought it was going to do. Those were right around $30 million for the weekend, both at $46 million for when you include Christmas Day. But The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, won the weekend with $41 million just for the three-day weekend. And it didn't do as well on Christmas Day because so many people were seeing Into the Woods and Unbroken, but it still had enough steam to get through the weekend. And like I said, also interesting to note, The Interview did a couple million dollars since it opened. And then Big Eyes was in like over 1,000 screens and it only did $3 million. That did not do well. That is not good. It had a miserable per screen average. And then The Gambler only made $9 million, $14 million if you count Christmas Day. Christmas Day was a huge day for movies this year. It was a huge box office day. And everything got at least something. I mean, Annie is up to $46 million. And it's off of its $65 million budget, which is pretty good, even though that movie's not that great. This week, I think that The Hobbit's going to keep holding on, because I think it's still good for about $20 to $25 million. And the only movie that's of any sort of competition is The Woman in Black 2, which that's going to make about $10 million. It, without any names to it, if it had Daniel Radcliffe somehow coming back for the sequel, it would have been a much bigger draw, but there's nobody that anyone can tack any sort of box office promise to. So $25 million for The Hobbit this weekend, and then it's into the depths of January. You're listening to Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD Roundup. It's actually really thin this week, and the reason is it's all because of Christmas. There aren't a whole lot of movies that are released on DVD after Christmas. That week of Christmas and the week after Christmas is kind of a vacuum of movies because most people have bought their stuff already. They've already ordered it from Amazon in early December. That's when a lot of the stuff is coming out. You have tons and tons of releases in the beginning of December. If you're buying something on December 23rd, it's out of desperation for a gift. And if you're buying something on December 30th for a DVD or Blu-ray, it's only because you really want it. So the only handful of releases that we have Tusk, which is Kevin Smith's body horror film about a man being turned into a walrus, which was very impressive until it gets to the third act, and completely falls apart and becomes awful. So if you like Kevin Smith and you want to see something different, you can check it out. But if you go watch it normally, turn it off before Johnny Depp shows up. There's also The Equalizer, which of course stars Denzel Washington in the reboot of the TV show. Actually, this was pretty good. I enjoyed this movie. It's a cathartic, violent movie that's fun to watch. Get the frustrations of everyday life out. It works for what it is. Then there's Pride, which is a true story in the UK in the 80s about a group of lesbians and gays and bisexuals who helped a bunch of minors on their strike and gave them some support. And it's a lighthearted film, but you know, positive for the gay and lesbian community. There's also Shameless season 4 from Showtime and Banshee season 2, which I don't know really much about. It was the only other one I saw on the list that was remotely for something about like criminals in Amish country. It was the only other thing I saw on the list of new DVDs that was even partly recognizable. And there's no stinker this week because there's so few releases. So that's my New Year's present to the studios for not trashing one of the films or TV shows on DVD. That's it. Next week, we're going to be talking about Taken 3, Selma, Inherent Vice. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.